I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Sarah Dowdy.
And I'm Deblina Chakraborty.
And we're going to continue with the Black History Month theme we've been working on. And initially, when I was trying to pick out a topic, I was thinking I would do something on a slave rebellion. And there are a lot of interesting slave rebellions out there. I was trying to pick between, you know, which one I wanted to cover. But ultimately, I ended up looking more into slave escapes. And there are a lot of interesting slave escapes, too. Some are really well known, like Harriet Tubman, obviously. Others are just kind of bizarre, like this guy, Henry Box Brown. He literally mailed himself to freedom. So that's pretty cool. But I don't know if we could talk about that for an entire podcast. But finally, I settled on the story of Ellen and William Craft because they had this really interesting story. It's really inspiring, but there's also an element of complete bizarreness to it, too. I don't know if that's
a twist. So to speak.
Yeah, that's a much more eloquent way of putting it. A twist, and it's a pretty interesting one. And once I discovered their story, I knew like that had to be the podcast for the week.
Yeah, so it involves a woman named Ellen, who was a 22-year-old slave who appeared to be white, and she would disguise herself as a young, sickly, well-off white man and travel by train and steamer to freedom. And she was accompanied by her husband, William, who was playing the part of a young man's faithful slave. And the really just mind-boggling part about this, to me anyway, is that it was only 8 days after thinking of this plan, this escape plan that they hatched, that the couple was completely free.
Yeah, and I think the mind-boggling part to me is that they are escaping from Macon, Georgia. So it's 1,000 miles from freedom, or to freedom, to get to the free states. It's amazing. If you think about going that far, and we're going to talk about their journey and all of the slave states they have to go through, this really long trip, this really harrowing trip.
It's, the obstacles they have to overcome.
Yeah, it's amazing. And that they were so, so ingenious to think of this disguise, this masquerading Ellen as a young man, and by doing that, breaking not only racial and sex boundaries, but class boundaries as well, since she's disguised as a pretty well-off country gentleman. Right. Pretty cool story.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of other people have their stories as well. They went on to become darlings of the abolition movement, and they ended up publishing the narrative of their journey called Running 1,000 Miles for Freedom. So, but the escape definitely wasn't easy, as we mentioned. It took a lot of planning, a lot of nerve. A lot of nerve, definitely. And so we're going to go a little bit into that right now.
Yeah, and the reason why they were willing to risk it, aside from just achieving their own freedom, is that they really couldn't stand the idea of having their own family someday and having it broken apart, having their children sold off, because that's how their early family lives had been. So Ellen was born in 1826 in Clinton, Georgia, and she was the daughter of her master, Major James Smith, and his slave, Maria Smith, a biracial slave. And she was often mistaken as a member of her master's white family, which is something that his wife, the plantation mistress, did not like at all. And Maria suffered and Ellen suffered because of this. They were not treated well on the plantation by the mistress. And so finally, when Ellen is 11 years old, the mistress finally gets rid of her. She gives her as a wedding present to her own daughter. And so Ellen moves. She's separated from her mother and
all her family and her friends.
And all her family, yeah. And she's away from this original, very cruel mistress, though.
So the mistress's daughter lives in Macon, Georgia, where Ellen eventually moves. And it's there that she meets William Craft, who at age 16, he's already seen his family torn apart piece by piece as well. First, his master sells off his mother and father as they grow older. Then they sell off his brother and then a sister, too. William and another brother were apprenticed to trades, though. I think his brother became a blacksmith, and he learned cabinet making and actually became quite skilled at it, so that was a positive for him. Before his apprenticeship was actually over, though, his master sold his brother and mortgaged William as well as his 14-year-old sister for cotton speculating money. The problem was, though, when he eventually couldn't make that payment, the children had to be sold off to different men to get the money to make up that difference. So William actually had to watch his sister stand on an auction block. They were both auctioned off. And it's really poignant how he describes this. We were talking a little bit about that earlier, about watching his sister being taken away and she's being loaded onto a cart to go home to her new master. And he just kind of has to watch. And since he's being auctioned off at the time, he can't even say goodbye to her.
He just wants to say goodbye. He asks another slave to ask the cart to wait for a second. He asks the guy who's auctioning to let him go and say goodbye, and nobody lets him. He just has to watch her drive away. It's probably one of the saddest parts of the narrative.
Yeah, heartbreaking. But then he's purchased by a bank cashier who sends him back to his apprenticeship. So that's kind of where he ends up. But in the narrative, William actually later admits that he and Ellen postponed their marriage for quite some time, even after they met and got to know each other, because they were afraid of having children that could be bought and traded as well. That was sort of the deal. If a mother had children and she was a slave, they were sort of already part of that way of life.
Yeah, they were the property of whoever owned her. And he even writes about this in the narrative quite poignantly. He writes, quote, "But after puzzling our brains for years, we were reluctantly driven to the sad conclusion that it was almost impossible to escape from slavery in Georgia and travel 1,000 miles across the slave states. We therefore resolved to get the consent of our owners, be married, settle down in slavery, and endeavor to make ourselves as comfortable as possible under that system." But, you know, no surprise here, they obviously don't settle down. They keep on thinking of a way to escape this system, even though they are so far away from free states. And finally, in December 1848, William hatches a plan, and it's a pretty amazing plan. It's that, well, Ellen could pass as white, and William could act as her slave, but white women didn't travel unaccompanied with a male slave. It just wasn't proper. It wasn't how things worked, and it wouldn't fly. So for this plan they're trying to cook up to actually work, Ellen would have to pass off not only as a white person, but as a man, because that's no surprise at all, a young white country gentleman traveling with his slave.
Well, there was another problem as well, too, that they had to overcome. Even after they figured out the perfect costume, time was a big factor. the best opportunity for them to leave would be at Christmas time, since that was the time when slaves were most likely to get time off from their masters. So after a little convincing, Ellen decides to go for this plan, decides maybe it'll work, and they quickly start to go to work on her disguise that they've devised.
Yeah, once she decides she's okay with it, they really swing into action. It's funny, though, in the narrative, William makes a really strong point of emphasizing that Ellen only agreed to this disguise, this cross-dressing disguise, because it was the only way possible. She was not, like, into it or something, and I just think that's it's kind of funny to look at certain ideas that people try to put into their own narrative, make sure they set the story straight.
Yeah, he wants her to still seem proper and not tarnish her character at all by this thing that she had to do.
Yeah, a proper Victorian lady. But in the meantime, you know, when this was actually going down, they were working hard on a disguise that would make her a convincing man. And so Ellen, who worked as a seamstress for her family, got to work on sewing men's pants. And then William went about town. He went to all these different suppliers so he wouldn't attract suspicion by buying too much from one person, and bought her hat and a coat and these high-heeled men's shoes to give her a little bit of extra height. And even my favorite touch, I think, is green spectacles, because she says that, you know, she's going to be in the company of men quite a bit, and she might feel a little more comfortable if she at least had some kind of eye shade, you know, something to hide behind, or at least make her feel more comfortable.
Yeah, it was kind of an ingenious touch. And it's interesting because they really thought about the little details like that. They thought about everything. They even, just so she wouldn't be asked to register their names in logbooks, because they were illiterate, they couldn't read and write at that point, Ellen made a sling for her right arm so that she wouldn't be asked to sign things. She'd have a good excuse, right? And to hide her beardless face and avoid long conversations with people, she wrapped her cheeks and chin in poultices and a white handkerchief. So, good way to deter anyone who wants to get too close to you.
Yeah, definitely. And right before they left on December 21st, that same year, 1848, with their, you know, they've obtained their passes from their masters, William cuts Ellen's hair about shoulder length, and all said and done, she looked like this very sickly, well-off country gentleman. It was a convincing disguise for sure. And so that morning they left their house, or they left Ellen's house, and they parted ways because obviously they didn't want anybody to catch them going from her house right to the train station. And they arrived there separately. It's interesting. I've actually been to this Macon train station.
Yes.
I think it's a museum today, but I feel like I've got a little part of history here. And Ellen buys their tickets, a ticket for her and for her slave, her supposed slave. She got into one of the nicer cars. William boarded one of the cars for slaves. And they're almost lost right from the start. All this careful planning they've put into it the past few days, they're almost betrayed before they even leave town.
Yeah, it's a really scary experience, actually. William spots the owner of the cabinet shop that he's worked for standing on the platform, and the guy actually has a little suspicion and starts walking through the train, but luckily he doesn't notice Ellen at all. I guess her
Can't
disguise
her.
Was in fact pretty good. And the whistle blows right before he gets to William's car.
So pretty close call there. Apparently the cabinet maker, his suspicions are allayed as soon as he realizes they're not on the train, or as soon as he thinks they're not on the train, goes home, doesn't give it any thought for the next few days since they do have passes. But meanwhile, Ellen is running into a little trouble of her own. She realized that she was sitting right next to a guy named Mr. Cray, who was a friend of her master's, and a guy who had been at the house recently for dinner and who knew her since she was a child. So somebody who, it seems like, pretty likely he could recognize her. So she doesn't want to chat with him because she's afraid that if he hears her and looks at her, it'll be enough to betray who she really is. So she feigns deafness, and he asks a few times, how about this weather, or along the lines of that, and she doesn't answer. And finally, he just about shouts it, and she says, oh, it's nice. And then he assumes she's deaf and doesn't try to chat any longer. But she spends the rest of the trip listening to him and his friends talk about cotton and slaves and abolitionists. So
sweating bullets, no doubt.
Yeah, it must have been a very, very uncomfortable ride.
So they reach Savannah safely, and from there, Ellen and William take a steamer bound for Charleston. Ellen is the master sleeping in the berth, of course, and William is on cotton bags on the deck. So it's here where the charade gets really interesting, if you didn't already think it was interesting enough before. To explain Ellen's bandages, her early bedtime, and the lack of social mingling on board the steamer, William spreads the word around that his master had terrible rheumatism and that they were on their way to Philadelphia for medical consultation. So William plays the part, too, publicly heating the bandages and really
talking about it a lot, too.
Yeah, definitely. Gossiping almost about the situation with his so-called master. And he did the job so well that people really took notice at this point. The captain told Ellen while she was disguised, "You have a very attentive boy, sir, but you had better watch him like a hawk when you get onto the north." And a slave dealer actually came up to her and offered to take William off of her hands since she'd certainly lose him once she got on free soil.
Yes, tries to buy William from her. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. I think she says, I couldn't get on without him.
Yeah.
But Ellen is pretty popular, too, as this young gentleman invalid. There's this chatty young officer who sort of tries to befriend her and give her pointers on how to treat her slave. He hears her thanking William and tells her, you should never talk to your slave like that. You have to be harsh with them. And you can imagine what Ellen is probably thinking
right to
that. But once they get to Charleston, she stays in this nice hotel and the staff preens on her, or him, as they think, for being so sickly, you know, warming up the poultices. And William is still playing that part, spreading the word, making everyone think this young man really needs to be carefully attended to. But they run into another hitch here, because from Charleston, they're supposed to take a steamer all the way to Philadelphia, which would be their final free destination. But unfortunately, the steamer that went to Philadelphia didn't run in the winter. And to make things even scarier for them, the last run that had been made, a stowaway had been found, a runaway slave. So
arousing suspicion
already. Yeah, everyone is kind of on edge, and I'm sure they were at this point too.
So they change their plan, and instead they end up taking the steamer to Wilmington, North Carolina instead. But they run into trouble there, too. The ticket seller was not cool with them signing their names William Johnson and Slave, which is what they'd been doing.
With him signing the name for them.
Right, exactly. He was suspicious because there had been kind of a crackdown on whites at that time traveling with unidentified black slaves with no proof of ownership. They could have been abolitionists, after all.
Yeah, the idea was that any white abolitionist could come to the South, pick up a slave, pretend it was his own, and then travel north to freedom. So they wanted proof of ownership and all this documentation. So consequently, travelers would be waylaid for quite some time. And that looks like what was going to be maybe happening to Ellen and William.
Fortunately, that wasn't the case, though, because several of Ellen's new cronies that she'd met on her previous ride stepped up to the plate. The young officer vouched for Mr. Johnson, pretending to know him very well.
Said he knew his kin.
And the steamboat captain volunteered to write the name for Ellen. So they were on board and in Wilmington by morning.
Yeah, and once they were in Wilmington, they kept on going, taking a train to Richmond, Virginia. And Ellen rode in this car with an old gentleman and his two daughters. And this might be one of the lightest or potentially, I mean, if you can have a light part of this narrative, I think this is it. Ellen is in this car with this old gentleman and his two lovely daughters. And again, all three of them are really concerned about this poor, sickly young man and his rheumatism. And judging by the narrative, it seems almost like the two daughters get a bit of a crush on this young Mr. Johnson.
Those poultices really drew them in.
They must have just felt so sorry for him. But William writes, quote, "They fell in love with the wrong chap." And I like William's little interjections of humor throughout the narrative. But even when things are going pretty well, you know, this old country gentleman giving his recipe for rheumatism relief to Ellen, there's still some close calls. And at Richmond, this old woman misidentified William as her runaway slave, and Ellen has to correct her, say, no, that's my slave, not your Ned. And after this, there's one little bit in the narrative that I find a little hard to swallow. And if you've read several slave narratives before, you know that sometimes it breaks down into a dialogue, which is more like a novel than a personal account. And this is that spot in Ellen and William's narrative, because reluctant to talk, Ellen, who has been feigning deafness and tying her head up with poultices, apparently asks this slew of pointed questions to this woman who has had her own slave run away and is looking for him. Questions like, was your slave married? What happened to his wife? Oh, you sold his wife. Things like that, trying to sort of make the old woman see the wrong of her ways.
Almost get a rise out of her.
Get a rise, yeah. So not only engaging in a long conversation, but a contentious conversation, trying to make this woman realize what she'd done. I don't know if I totally buy that. It might have been more of a to-the-point conversation if she was having it.
It does seem a little tough to believe, but nevertheless, they pressed on to D.C. from there and took the train to Baltimore. At this point, we're at Christmas Eve. It's the last slave port before freedom. But because it was the last slave port before Pennsylvania, it was really tough to get through. Ellen and William were removed from the train. Ellen had to speak with the railroad officer who asked them to prove ownership at that point. And she argued, in fact, that she had already bought tickets in Charleston to go all the way through to Philadelphia, but the guy wouldn't budge. And when the departure bell rang, he suddenly just broke. He let them go.
He says, so this guy's clearly not well. Let's just let him through. I don't see any harm in it.
Yeah, I mean, they just scraped by.
Very, very close call. And there's a really frightening part in the narrative when Ellen, who has been arguing admirably with this railroad officer, finally doesn't know what else to say and just looks at William, and they're both terrified they're going to do something, make some faux pas, or just be betrayed by their emotions finally and be lost right here at the very end. But yeah, fortunately they get on the train and they arrived in Philadelphia free. And as soon as they were out of the station, you can imagine the relief. Ellen breaks down sobbing, and they traveled to an abolitionist run boarding house in the city. Interestingly, a free black man on the train had told William about it, urging him to run away from his master as soon as he got on to free soil. It proved to be useful information. And once they were in Pennsylvania, they were really welcomed by the abolitionist network and kind of shuttled about to different towns, because even though Pennsylvania was a free state, it was not a safe place to be because it was a border state. It was someplace where slave hunters could run in, essentially, grab slaves and take them back into the South.
So luckily, with the help of this abolitionist network, they kind of dodge around a little bit. They're shuttled about. And during that time, they're giving reading lessons. Finally, they're sent to Boston, though, since Pennsylvania is unsafe. But Boston wasn't exactly safe either, especially after something called the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. Now, Congress passed this law in exchange for Southern support of California entering the Union as a free state and the slave trade ending in the district. It meant that federal commissioners were allowed to hunt down runaways in any state, no matter how long the slave had been free.
Yeah, so it put Ellen and William at risk, even in relatively safe Boston. And not long after that, Ellen and William's former masters hire these slave hunters named Willis Hughes and John Knight, and they essentially stalk the couple. I mean, they are looking for them and presumably would have taken them back to Macon by force. And abolitionists are hiding Ellen and William and again shuttling them about to keep them away from these slave hunters. And this is another harrowing detail of this story, but when they're finally legally married on November 7th, 1850, because of course, their first marriage wasn't a legal ceremony. But when they're finally legally married, the officiant gave William a revolver and a knife and told him, defend yourself and defend your wife with this if slave hunters try to get you.
Wow.
Pretty scary.
So they end up moving to England. While they're there, they have five kids. They have a boarding house and an import business for West African goods. They end up publishing their memoir, as we already know, and they release Ellen's portrait in her disguise. And this sells really, really well. So well, in fact, that William mentions he hopes he might use the funds one day to buy his sister out of slavery. So yeah, this is one thing that he's held on to, the sad idea of seeing a sister say goodbye, and he ends up finding out where she is in Mississippi and trying to find a way to get her back.
Yeah, and about the portrait too. I mean, you can search for this online and find it, but there's Ellen in her top hat, and she's depicted without the facial poultices, so you can see what she looks like. I think they made the decision that picture might sell a little better. But yeah, they're doing well for themselves in England, and they really use their fame and connections to promote the anti-slavery cause too. They even appeared in the Crystal Palace exhibit, which was, of course, the 1851 London World's Fair. And it wasn't in sort of the exhibitionist way you might expect them to be shown as part of a World's Fair. Instead, they just walked around the Crystal Palace arm in arm with really famous, prominent abolitionists of the opposite gender. So I think it caused quite a stir, because for Ellen and the abolitionist she's walking with, it looks like a white man and a white woman just strolling about London together.
Equals.
And that was the point of having their display like that, to show that the abolitionists in England considered them their equals. They respected their story of escape.
So, like you said, they have some respect there, and they seem to have acquired a pretty good life. But after the 15th Amendment was ratified in 1870, they actually came home to Georgia with two of their kids and set up a school for former slaves and a farm.
And Davlina and I were speculating on this a little earlier about why they came back. And I mean, I guess I can see a few different reasons. They might have wanted to live in their home again as free people. They might have wanted to prove a point, like, we can go back, and so we will. We don't have to be fugitives anymore. But I guess I kind of think the most likely explanation is maybe they wanted to help their people. So former slaves from Georgia who could get the opportunities they had gotten, like learning how to read and write and establish trades. I don't know, though.
Yeah, we can't know for sure, but what we do know is that things weren't that easy for them, really, when they came back. Their farm ended up failing because cotton prices started to drop. Their school had to close, and William was actually accused at one point of using school funds
for personal
gain, and the KKK threatened them as well. I mean, that's not that surprising, I guess, but it occurred also. And in 1890, they ended up moving to Charleston to live with their daughter. Ellen died in 1891 and William in 1900.
Yeah, and out of this whole narrative, if you go and read the whole thing, which it's all available online, I'd recommend doing it. It's not only an interesting story, but it is interesting to hear William's own words. But we've got to point out that you don't really get Ellen's side of the story out of the whole thing, because even though she's the one who is keeping up this elaborate ruse, you know, the one arguing with the railroad officer and feigning deafness and chatting with the young army officer, it's very much William's story in the account. And the stress of it was apparently so much that she was sick for quite some time after they arrived in the Free State. So I wish we had a little more from her, you know?
I wish we did too, especially because apparently there were rumors circulating that she had turned herself over to an American in London and that she missed slavery.
Yeah. Well, that's one point though where we do get to hear a little bit from her, and it's such an interesting glimpse into who this woman was, who had sort of faded into the background after the exciting escape. You know, she had assumed the role of the proper Victorian wife who, when William would present their story during lectures, she would stand quietly by his side and did a little bit of work out of the home, but mostly was working as a wife and mother. It is interesting when we finally get to hear her stand up for her own freedom.
Yeah, and we have a quote from her here. She says, I never had the slightest inclination whatever of returning to bondage. And God forbid that I should ever be so false to liberty as to prefer slavery in its stead. In fact, since my escape from slavery, I have gotten much better in every respect than I could have possibly anticipated. Though, had it been to the contrary, my feelings in regard to this would have been just the same, for I had much rather starve in England, a free woman, than be a slave for the best man that ever breathed upon the American continent. Yours very truly, Ellen Craft.
I think that's probably the best way to end a podcast like this, in Ellen's own words.
I hardly agree.
And so if you have any other great runaway slave stories you want to share with us, I mean, I think these are so fascinating and touching. We'd love to hear your favorites, or maybe some that you'd like us to try to cover at some point. You can contact us through Twitter at Missed in History. You can send us an email at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. And we're also on Facebook. And if you want to learn a little bit more about how the more classic runaway slave escape went, not this elaborate disguise, although there were a few other women who cross-dressed their way to freedom, Clarissa Davis and Mary Milbourn and Maria Weems. But if you want to learn more of the classic story about the Underground Railroad, we do have an article on that. It's called How the Underground Railroad Worked, and you could find it by searching for Underground Railroad on our homepage at www.howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Meet Tomboy X. Makers of the original boxer briefs for women, Tomboy X designs gender and size-inclusive underwear and apparel. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase, only at TomboyX.com.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie, ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.